this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline for the Triangle Business Journal. We hope they are right. IBM, arguably the primary reason for RTP's success, is amid transformation. Question is whether the Triangle will play a role in the company's future. And that's the headline on the front page. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. IBM's fade into black. RTP's key tenant is seeking new paths to prosperity, and thousands of Triangle jobs are at stake. This article is written by Lauren K. Onisorge. Jim Zidar's startup, Steals, is on the rise. He has signed on hundreds of restaurants through corporate customers such as McDonald's and Bojangles for his business, which rewards restaurant-goers with free food for engaging with brands on social media. 2 years ago, his app worked with about 800 restaurant locations. Today, it's 1,500 and growing. Zidar is readying to take Raleigh's Steals to a new level, figuring out ways to predict customer behavior so his brands can better interact with customers. And in what might be a surprise to some, he decided to partner with IBM. While IBM can be seen as old school and stuffy, Zidar believes IBM and its Watson technology is a perfect fit for him. Zidar and entrepreneurs like him are a vital part of an IBM transformation plan. The stakes are high for the Triangle, with thousands of people making their daily trips to 3039 East Cornwallis Road and neighboring buildings. In Research Triangle Park, Big Blue is still considered to be the largest employer, even though it hasn't released an official headcount since the 10,000 number in 2008, several layoff waves ago. But one thing is certain, IBM is far smaller today in RTP compared to what it was in 2008. IBM CEO Ginni Rometty, who took over in 2012, is amid a massive transformation of a company that many in the Triangle say was the primary driver of RTP's success in the past 50 years. Ann Rometty has a dedicated soldier in Fran O'Sullivan, the RTP site lead. Big Blue is trying to transform a business known for hardware into a business based on something much less tangible, cloud computing. Big data and artificial intelligence, notably Watson, the firm's Jeopardy-winning cognitive computing technology. But none of the strategy works if IBM is not able to attract skilled talent. To that effect, IBM is even trying to appear hip, with ads showing Carrie Fisher of Star Wars fame conversing with robots and Bob Dylan discussing his lyrics with Watson. Desperate to reinvent. Much of the effort to reinvent IBM happens at RTP in offices that used to house the PC and server business, both divested to nearby Lenovo in the past 11 years. For IBM and its RTP operations, Watson may be the trump card as Big Blue seeks to challenge the likes of Apple, Facebook, Google, and others. Watson, along with other strategic growth targets such as security, big data, and the Internet of Things, are where the bulk of IBM's investment dollars are going. But the brand needs to move with that strategy shift, and the data shows the Big Blue brand trails behind its own innovation. 5 years ago, IBM was the number two brand behind Coca-Cola, according to Interbrand's Best Brand List. In 2015, it was fifth, trailing names such as Apple and Google. One of the top three brands in 2015, only Coca-Cola was even on the list 15 years ago. A list by CoreLogic is even more harsh in its assessment of the IBM brand's power. IBM, the 18th most powerful brand in 2007, ranked 24th in 2016. For Zidar, that could be part of why IBM wasn't on his radar, and its competitors, companies such as Microsoft, were. Microsoft actually approached him first about a similar artificial intelligence partnership, he says. But then I did some research, Zidar says. He reached out to an RTP engineer who soon put him on a plane to IBM's New York headquarters. Days later, he was officially a part of IBM's global entrepreneurship initiative with access to Watson. And as his business grows, it's likely he'll stay faithful to IBM, he says. This technology, it's moving so fast, Zidar says. It's impressive. What Watson can do, honestly, it's amazing. And that's the kind of story O'Sullivan loves to hear. Entrepreneurs like Zidar are part of the reason her team has branched out, opening closet-sized offices at NC State University and the Frontier at RTP. While Watson, named for Thomas Watson, the IBM leader who drove the company to greatness in the early 20th century, is based in New York, it's supported at RTP, she says. And IBM uses Watson as a tool to connect with both entrepreneurs and researchers in both spaces. Watson and strategic imperatives in general are of particular importance to the RTP campus, which found itself without a campus identity when it was no longer the headquarters for IBM's PC and server business. O'Sullivan says that presented an opportunity. We really can be a little bit of everything, she says, adding that virtually every IBM business has representation at RTP, which is good news for bet hedging in a world where technology is constantly changing. We do view it as an asset, she adds. The RTP connection. And IBM also serves as ground zero to some of its more nimble, experimental businesses in RTP, such as blockchain. John Wolpert, IBM's RTP-based blockchain offering director, told a crowd at a Raleigh technology conference last month that the transaction technology unit considers the Triangle ground zero for the next internet, and he too is competing for startups in that space, which is why he frequently works out of the NCSU office to be accessible to young innovators. Blockchain, made famous by Bitcoin, involves a distributed ledger that makes it easy to track virtually anything of value, all without requiring a central point of control. And through open source projects in conjunction with companies such as Red Hat, IBM is trying to make a dent in the space, and it's doing so from the Triangle. But units such as blockchain aren't just competing for entrepreneurial partnerships, they're also competing for hires. We're not having any problems attracting the best people, IBM Chief Financial Officer Martin Schrader said in May, but he did admit that there aren't enough STEM-qualified hires to go around. The world doesn't create these skills fast enough. IBM hired 70,000 of 1.1 million applications in 2015, he said, adding that across the company, 50% of IBMers have been with the firm 5 years or less. But that statistic drops to 30% in RTP, according to O'Sullivan, meaning that IBM could be behind the hiring curve, especially in light of the fact that legacy businesses used to be the lifeblood of the campus. O'Sullivan says newer hires provide a big benefit, as those new to Big Blue invigorate legacy employees and give them new mentorship roles. But the company, without being specific, has confirmed multiple layoff rounds have hit legacy employees at RTP. Lee Conrad, former spokesman for the union trying to represent IBM, has repeatedly said those rounds have impacted morale, and he has attributed the cuts to offshoring, jobs being relocated to places such as India, where tech talent can be bought in cheaper. While the company says it hires more than it fires overall, it doesn't say how many of those hires are local or even domestic. O'Sullivan says the bulk of layoffs that have hit RTP have been about the transformation, as divestments of the PC business and the bulk of the server business, both previously based in RTP, to Lenovo, have left many legacy IBM hardware skills irrelevant. And investments, including new hires, are being prioritized in those businesses that IBM has identified as high growth, such as cybersecurity and big data. You do have to be a little patient, O'Sullivan says. Changing culture does take longer than you think. Time running out. Bill Crayer, an analyst at Edward Jones, says investors, too, are trying to be patient, and those strategic areas across the company are growing at a sufficient rate to overtake legacy businesses, but the hardware businesses are declining at such a rapid rate that it makes overall growth difficult, he says. The company has product cycles around their server products, and they're clearly cycling down on the majority of those businesses, so in some ways that's speeding up the shift toward software. But the overall revenue continues to decline, Crayer says. It's still unclear if the company can maintain double-digit growth in their strategic imperatives, he says. As a technology analyst, he has seen these types of stories before, where companies such as IBM, Cisco, NetApp, and EMC tried to develop a narrative to bridge the old and new business lines. They've struggled, really, to provide the necessary commentary to appease nervous shareholders, he says of IBM. And investors won't wait forever. IBM has had bleak days before. More than two decades ago, The Economist wondered publicly whether a firm the size of IBM could ever react quickly enough to compete. Larry Ellison, then CEO of IBM competitor Oracle, famously said of Big Blue at the time, "We don't even think of those guys anymore. They're not dead, but they're irrelevant." But despite losing $8 billion in 1993, IBM, under the direction of then-CEO Lou Gerstner, would turn things around, with shares rising more than 10 times in 6 years. Via his memoir, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance, Gerstner said IBM's biggest challenge in turning around its balance sheet wasn't in its technology, but in its culture. And he wasn't just talking about its white shirt and tie dress code, which he abolished. Changing the attitude and behavior of thousands of people is very, very hard to accomplish. You can't mandate it. What you can do is create the conditions for transformation, he wrote. Physical change. In an executive floor where long white hallways used to dominate, O'Sullivan has ordered the walls knocked down. In their stead, adjustable desks, open space, and collaboration own the floor, what she calls an agile workspace. Even her own office has a glass wall and an open door policy. But just like many other changes it has incorporated in recent years, Big Blue's critics argue IBM is behind. Companies whose workspaces have long been agile in the triangle are getting even more creative. Tax software firm Avalara added a tiki hut. Morrisville digital marketing software maker MaxPoint has long had events such as Tequila Tuesdays. And Durham email marketer Bronto, acquired by NetSuite and then Oracle, has beer taps and social hours. But at least we're doing it, O'Sullivan says when presented with information that IBM's agile concept is one adopted by some of its competitors a decade ago. O'Sullivan says it's not just about where people work, though she has pulled back workers to the office who had previously been working remotely, but about what they're actually doing. You have to be able to reinvent yourself and reskill yourself to be successful going forward, O'Sullivan says. Kids entering college today, half of them will enter a career that doesn't exist when they started. And if you can't reinvent yourself along with IBM, you're just holding it back, she says, pointing out that IBM, whose first product was a meat slicer, has long been about change. We have to go up an incredibly rapid curve in order to transform our company, she says. How do you handle that rate and pace of change? And it's IBM's ability to adapt that could save its brand once again. Stacy Wood, Langdon Distinguished University Professor of Marketing at NCSU, says large brands such as IBM can fall prey to a term she calls marketing myopia, where companies are seeing their outputs in terms of specific products or services instead of in terms of customer needs. To stay relevant, IBM needs to look outside of its own customer insights and figure out what the customer really wants. And they need to work on branding when it comes to their inner audience, their employees. Many successful brands work deliberately at internal branding so that their employees feel an increase in pride and purpose, which then, hopefully, translates into an increase in word-of-mouth advocacy and productivity, she says. That's what O'Sullivan has been doing. She says she identifies influencers within her organization and turns them into evangelists as part of her management process. It's working, she says. But while Crayer says he maintains an optimistic outlook on the stock, he says investor patience has its limits. IBM needs to shift gears and quickly, or else lose the relevance it worked so hard to maintain. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, Medical Society turns basement into gym. The North Carolina Medical Society has a full gym in its basement, complete with a personal trainer, thanks to a confluence of events when the society had space and a personal trainer needed room. Olivier Arundo, who was born in France, was a wrestler who was hit by a car while riding a bicycle and bedridden for a year. He recovered and landed in Raleigh in 2006 with a dream of opening a gym. He worked at Gold's Gym and then bought equipment and began training clients out of his Garner home. Enter Bob Seligson, CEO of the North Carolina Medical Society. Arundo had already been training Seligson for some time. In 2009, Seligson offered Arundo about 2,000 square feet of space at the Medical Society office just behind the executive mansion. "I said, this is perfect," Arundo remembers. The Medical Society advocates for physicians in the state. Seligson realized it can be difficult for an employee to work for 8 hours per day, maintain a family, and still exercise. He decided to renovate the downstairs of the Medical Society space into a larger gym. If any of the 30 Medical Society employees work out with Arondo, the organization subsidizes the membership, and Arondo says he gets about 20% of his business through the office just upstairs. He now has 40 clients and loves his unusual location for his facility. I am happy here, he says. Pepper Celebration includes Pepper Beer. The 9th annual Pepper Festival at Briar Chapel in Chapel Hill raised approximately $30,000 on October 2 for Abundance NC. The event, which supports sustainable foods, fuels, and funds, has raised a total of $100,000 to date. More than 2,000 attendees showed up to support and sample pepper-themed food and drink from businesses such as the Farrington Granary, Centro, St. Jock's, Full Steam Brewery, Carolina Brewery, Crude Bitters, and much more. Winning the award for Best Brew, which was a combination of Yesteryear's Brewery and Full Steam for a pepper beer titled Julius Peppers, after the former UNC Chapel Hill football star. Other awards went to Top of the Hill Distillery for Spectacular Spirit, Farrington Granary for Most Creative Southern Culture Dish, Triangle Gluten-Free for Most Unexpected Dish, and Lily Den Farm for the Best in Show Dish. And in a section called Hollywood Tie, he manages both money and films. Atlanta Capital Group managing partner Troy Butter is leading a double life. Butter, a wealth management expert whose prior firm, Tri-Pillar Investments, merged with ACG 2 years ago, jets once a quarter to Los Angeles, but it's not about money management. It's about his side gig as a film producer. Disney's The Queen of Katwe, which was released at the end of September, is his latest project. The Tri-Pillar Investments Group merger actually gave him more time to pursue these types of projects, he tells Biz, and he doesn't plan on slowing down anytime soon. Butter says he's already working on his next project, also set in Africa. I really feel called to the inspirational, motivational, true life story genre, he says. His next film will be an adaptation of the book Left to Tell, a first-person account of genocide in Rwanda, penned by Immaculee Ilbagiza. Durham Company gets stunning camera. Durham-based Horizon Productions has been selected to be part of Google's Early Access Jump program, a move that makes it the only company in the Southeast with a GoPro Odyssey camera. And Jason Cooper, director of multimedia for the firm, tells Biz he's already putting it to good use. It lets us shoot in stereoscopic 3D 360 video, he explains, adding that it compresses a process that typically takes months and hundreds of man hours. The company shoots with the camera, uploads the footage, and renders it in the cloud in hours, and Horizon has already been shooting around town. To get the device, which cost about $15,000, company execs submitted 360 projects to Google and then flew to New York to learn about the device. Hang with artists in cool Raleigh homes. A popular dinner event that raises thousands of dollars for arts education returns in November in Raleigh. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner will be held November 3 through 5 in Raleigh and will include well-known artists like singer Tiff Merritt, sculptor Thomas Sayre, and jazz musician Eric Oberstein. On November 3 and 4, the event will include private dinners at 10 area homes, and each meal will include a surprise guest from the world of the arts. Some of the hosts are Julia and Frank Daniels, Noel and Harold Lichten, Charlene Newsom, and Lisa and Ven Poole. Then, on November 5, the event includes drinks at the gracious Oakwood home of Trish and John Healy, followed by dinner at Burning Coal Theater. That event will seat 184 guests and will include an artist at each table. This is the 12th year of the event, which has raised more than $1 million overall. Tickets are $175 each and available online at www.unitedarts.org. RDU leader named Director of the Year. Airport Revenue News has named Raleigh-Durham International Airport CEO Michael Landguth its 2016 Director of the Year in the Medium Airports category. This means he'll be interviewed and featured on the cover of ARN's November issue. In a statement, Landguth called the designation an honor. I have been blessed by a supportive board, team, and community. It is their support that distinguishes RDU from so many other airports across the country, and I couldn't be more proud of what we have accomplished together. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Real Estate, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Target in talks to replace bowling alley on Raleigh's Hillsborough Street. Business and real estate sources around downtown Raleigh are confirming knowledge that serious talks are underway to bring a smaller format Target store to Raleigh's Hillsborough Street. Target officials, they say, are in discussions to build a new store at the site of the Alley Bowling Center at 2512 Hillsborough Street. A longtime owner of the property, Natalie Blomquist, declined to comment about a pending deal to sell the property. It's a private thing, she said when reached by phone at her Lexington home. Sources say the Blomquist family, which has owned the 45,000-square-foot bowling alley building near the NC State University campus since 1963, are looking to sell the property to a group led by Raleigh attorney and real estate developer Michael Sandman. Sandman and his family also own and manage several other properties along Hillsborough Street and helped develop the new Aloft Hotel across from NCSU. Sandman did not return calls for comment. The owners of the Alley Bowling Center, brothers Chris and Jimmy Poole, say they have been told by their landlord that the building could be sold before the end of the year, but they were unaware of the details of the property's future plans. The Pools have been the owners of the former Western Lanes Bowling Alley since 2008. We've got our own exciting plans in the works, and hopefully we'll be sharing our plans sooner rather than later, Jimmy Poole says. Target announced in July it would be opening one of its first smaller format stores in North Carolina in 2017 as an anchor retailer at the new Carolina Square building project underway on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Massive warehouses coming to Knightdale. An Indiana real estate developer of industrial properties who has found wide success in the Triangle in the past couple of years is getting ready to break ground on another ambitious industrial park project in Knightdale near the intersection of Interstate 540 and US 264. Indianapolis-based Scannell Properties in late September purchased the first piece of a 79-acre assemblage slated for the new Eastgate 540 industrial park, according to county records. The firm plans to break ground immediately for the construction of the first of two 150,000-square-foot warehouse properties that will be part of Phase 1 for the nearly 1 million-square-foot industrial park. The park could have as many as six buildings. Scannell purchased the first 24-acre tract land from members of the Murphy, Myrick, and Hicks families and paid $1.7 million for the property. Chester Allen with CBRE Raleigh, who helped represent the sellers in the deal, says the property is one he originally had assembled for Duke Realty Corporation in 2008 until the economic downturn scuttled those plans. The Triangle second quarter warehouse vacancy rate was less than 11%. In the Triangle, Scannell was a partner with Raleigh-based Brookwood Capital Partners in the construction of a 160,000-square-foot warehouse on Rogers Lane in East Raleigh. Scannell also built or is building two more industrial buildings at TBC Industrial in the RTP I-40 submarket in Durham. Popular Charlotte food store coming to Cameron Village. A popular Charlotte specialty food store, Reed's Fine Foods, will be opening its first shop outside of the Charlotte metro area this holiday season at Raleigh's Cameron Village Retail District. Reed's Fine Foods will be filling the 4,700-square-foot space that the Chapel Hill-based specialty grocer and gift shop store Southern Season had vacated suddenly in the summer after filing for bankruptcy. Southern Season has since been sold and has retreated back to its single-store location in Chapel Hill. The new Reed store at Cameron Village is expected to open in late October and remain open through early January. There's also a good chance, Reed's owner, Tom Coker, says, that the holiday pop-up store at Cameron Village could become a permanent year-round store. If sales go well, we will open a full-time store, Coker says. We think Cameron Village is a nice fit for who we are and how we want to grow the company. It's the perfect spot for Reed's expansion into the Raleigh market. Parade of Homes showcases triangle houses. A joint Parade of Homes event by the two home builders associations representing Wake, Durham, Orange, and Chatham counties kicked off October 1 and will continue to run each weekend through October 16. The parade, which is a free self-guided tour, showcases more than 250 finished or nearly finished new homes by builders from across the region. Some highlights. The most expensive home on the tour is a $2 million 5-bedroom, 5-bathroom house by Gray Line Builders at Preston Plantation in Cary. The tour has 24 homes priced at $1 million or more, which is twice the number of million-dollar homes on display than in 2015. HGTV's 2016 Smart Home in Raleigh's Haywood neighborhood will be open for tours after the winner of the sweepstakes opted to take the cash prize instead. Some of the proceeds from the sale of the house, which is listed at $899,900, will go to the American Heart Association as the tour's Go Red House. Chesapeake Homes will be donating $1,000 to the Susan G. Komen Foundation for every sale of a Chesapeake-built home that's on the parade tour through October 31. And there is a Christmas-decorated house at 2135 Vecchio Lane in Apex that will also have visits from Santa. The house is listed at $799,990. And now we turn to the On Banking page written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, local towns not dropping Wells Fargo yet. As Wells Fargo's home state of California suspends much of its banking relationship with the institution over a scandal involving unauthorized accounts, other government agencies around the country are considering following suit. For example, the mayor of Philadelphia has publicly threatened to switch banks. Not so in North Carolina, however, where Wells acts as the state's primary banker. And metros around the Triangle, too, use Wells as their primary depository, including Raleigh, Cary, Morrisville, Garner, and Knightdale. None of the metros have had formal discussions about switching banks. But that's partially because of how extensive a town's banking relationship really is. Changing our banking services is a very complex, long process because we have so many integrated, automated functions within the bank, Karen Mills, chief financial officer of the town of Cary, said recently. But there are those who think it might be worth the trouble. David Andrews, town manager of the town of Carrboro, which banks with BB&T, says he's glad that some government organizations are examining their relationship with the bank. I am glad that Congress is holding Mr. Stumpf accountable for his actions, he said in an email referring to Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf. It is also absolutely appalling that Wells Fargo would be preying on our military service members. The state of North Carolina has $155.6 million in Wells Fargo bank balances and is monitoring the situation, says North Carolina State Treasurer's Office spokesman Brad Young. And in tech news, SideQuest CEO resigns, but company still committed to Morrisville. Longtime SideQuest CEO Steve Wee has officially resigned. SideQuest, which was recently acquired by private equity firm Accel KKR, confirms technology veteran Robert Bonavito has taken his place. Bonavito, speaking to Triangle Business Journal in an exclusive interview, confirmed a management shakeup. When a new CEO comes in, there are usually some changes at the top, he said, adding that the company is still committed to Morrisville. North Carolina is our headquarters. We plan to continue to have North Carolina as our headquarters. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Inc. Research taps new COO. Raleigh's Inc. Research has appointed Michael Ghibertini as its chief operating officer, the contract research organization announced October 3. Austin, Texas-based Ghibertini succeeds new CEO Alastair McDonald in the role, and Tara Fitzgerald, Executive Vice President of Biometrics, will succeed Ghibertini in his previous post as President of Clinical Development Services. The company said the promotions of Ghibertini and Fitzgerald have been made in conjunction with its previously announced CEO succession plan. In July, Inc. Research announced that Alastair McDonald would take the company's reins from Jamie McDonald, no relation, effective October 1. At the time, the company said Alastair McDonald would also take over Jamie McDonald's seat on Inc. Research's board of directors, though the latter McDonald would stay on as the company's vice chairman until the end of February. "I am thrilled to assume the role of CEO of Inc. Research at this exciting time in our growth. With our 2016 to 2018 business strategy well underway, our direction is clear, and we remain focused on our mission of helping biopharmaceutical customers worldwide bring new medicines to market for patients in need," Alastair McDonald said. Last month, Inc. Research offered several top executives, including Ghibertini, retention bonuses amid its leadership changes. Chapel Hill-based College Advising Corps is celebrated in visit to the White House. Nicole Hurd, founder and chief executive officer of Chapel Hill-based nonprofit College Advising Corps, was named one of 11 champions of change for college opportunity by the White House on September 30. Hurd's organization advises low-income students across the U.S. about college. It got its big break 2 years after it started when, in 2007, it secured a $10 million partnership with UNC Chapel Hill, the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, and nine other colleges. It is now an independent nonprofit, partnering with 15 more colleges and inking big-name corporate partnerships. College Advising Corps has served 848,000 high school students to date through 600 recent graduate advisors. This school year, the organization is serving more than 180,000 students. College Advising Corps is currently partnered with four North Carolina colleges: UNC Chapel Hill, which has 51 advisors, NC State University with 21, Davidson College 18, and Duke University 16. During the last academic year, those 106 advisors helped students secure roughly $179 million in institutional aid and $58 million in outside scholarships, according to College Advising Corps. Hurd, reached by phone in Washington, D.C., said she attributes the organization's continued growth to its college partners and recent graduate advisors, as well as funding from the John M. Belk Endowment in North Carolina, the Social Innovation Fund, AmeriCorps, private investors, and corporations. Hurd said the goal is reaching 1.4 million low-income high school seniors each year. Quintiles, IMS Health complete merger. 5 months after Durham-based Quintiles announced it had agreed to an all-stock merger with IMS Health, a deal with a market capitalization topping $17 billion, the tie-up is official. Quintiles announced October 3 it has completed the $9 billion deal with IMS, creating Quintiles IMS Holdings Incorporated. Shares of IMS Health have been converted into 0.3840 shares of Quintiles stock, the company said. Last month, IMS Health increased an offering it planned to pay down debt related to the merger to $1.75 billion from a previously announced $1.5 billion. Quintiles CEO Tom Pike will serve as vice chairman and president of Research and Development Solutions of 50,000-employee Quintiles IMS. The company will also keep headquarters in Connecticut and RTP. As for Triangle Jobs, a Quintiles IMS spokesman said, the merger is intended to accelerate growth in the combined company. The portfolios of the two companies are complementary, and there is little overlap in the service portfolios. Morningstar firm moving downtown in Raleigh, Durham. Morningstar Law Group will relocate its existing offices at Research Triangle Park and on St. Mary Street in Raleigh to new spaces in downtown Raleigh and downtown Durham, the firm announced October 3. The firm's new Raleigh office at 421 Fayetteville Street will open in January, while its new Durham office at 112 West Main Street will open in December. We're a very entrepreneurial model, so our view was to move our people to those expanding hubs in downtown Raleigh and downtown Durham, said Morningstar partner Annie Carmack. While the firm first selected RTP for its office back in 2012, when a group of a dozen attorneys broke off from K&L Gates and Womble Carlyle Sandridge and Rice to found the firm, Carmack said that Morningstar now needs to be part of the continued development in the downtown business areas in Raleigh and Durham. The new locations will allow the firm to be close to many of its clients, she added. Carmack said the relocations are part of a firm growth strategy focused on deepening its existing benches. Primary practice areas include business litigation, real estate and land use, technology and business law, she said. 20 of the firm's lawyers will move to the Fayetteville Street office, while 5 will populate the office in Durham. There will be mobility between the new offices, she said. Morningstar operated in RTP until earlier this year when it bolted on the four-attorney firm of Wood Jackson. The IP and technology litigation firm provided Morningstar its office on St. Mary Street. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page and we start with the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Hey Congress, Think Beyond Stumpf. Don't look at the Wells Fargo wagon wheel for stability, at least for now. The California Bank CEO John Stumpf is getting grilled from all sides because of the bank's questionable practices of opening up fake customer accounts to keep up with quotas and then charging customers fees for those fake accounts. Just like Martin Shkreli, CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals, and Dick Fuld, Jr., CEO of Lehman Brothers, and so many others, this too shall pass for Stumpf, one way or another. It may look bad for him now, but things will settle down, and whether he is still employed or not, there are enough senior executives at the bank who can right the ship and embark on a plan to lure back customers. But what about the Wells Fargo board? Why is Congress not calling each and every one of them and asking them questions about what they knew and why did they not know about this outright fraud? Excluding Stumpf, Wells Fargo's board has 14 prominent members, from past presidents of companies to educators to past heads of government agencies, and even a former major general and commander of the United States Air Force. Also included in this board is John Chen, the embattled CEO of BlackBerry Limited, who has bigger problems in his own hands than worrying about what's going on with Wells, one of the most profitable banks in the world. In all, among the 14 outside board members, Wells Fargo's website lists 9 of the board members have retired from their main jobs. Some of them are actively involved in other activities, but they have all retired from the jobs that brought them the success, power, influence, and prominence. Given what has happened in the past few days, one has to ask, exactly what has the board been doing all these years? Executive compensation data firm Equilar notes the median annual board compensation at the 6 biggest U.S. banks was $349,027 last year, nearly $80,000 more than the median director pay at S&P 500 companies. At Wells Fargo, at least half of the directors made more than the $349,000 median per year, and one, Enrique Hernandez Jr., made more than $400,000 in cash, stock, and other compensation. That may be one of the reasons why some of them may be on that board in the first place, attend a few committee and full board meetings every quarter, and move on. But if these directors with their committees had all these meetings in the past 5 years, why did this account manipulation scheme never come up? What were these guys asking? For that, I wanted to see just how many meetings the Audit and Examination Committee, AEC, had in 2015. The AEC oversees the integrity of the bank's financial statements and the adequacy and reliability of disclosures to stockholders, including internal control of financial reporting. According to Wells, there were 14 such committee meetings in 2015. The committee is headed by the 64-year-old John Quigley, who was the CEO of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited, the accounting giant's global network. Upon his retirement, Quigley was named CEO Emeritus at Deloitte. Quigley was assisted by Federico Pena, the former U.S. Secretary of Energy and U.S. Secretary of Transportation, in that committee. Other committee members include John Baker II, a Jacksonville, Florida-based chairman of FRP Holdings, who also was on the board of Duke Energy and Raleigh's Progress Energy, Susan Swenson, CEO of Novatel, and Suzanne Vautrinot, one of the newest members of the Wells board and also was a former major general of the U.S. Air Force. In many ways, this committee was supposed to make sure everything was kosher as part of their jobs. Come time for the full board meeting, Committee Chair Quigley gave the report, after which things were ratified. So, if what Trump is being grilled on now has been going on for years, and this committee meets more than 12 times a year, they had more than 60 committee meetings in the last 5 years, and no one had any idea that this was going on? The same Wells board waited until Stump was in front of the U.S. Senate testifying about the fake accounts before clawing back $41 million in unvested stock awards. If they had done this days, weeks, or months before, they would have gained credibility. But it sure looks like it was the public furor that caused the board to react. The next step for the U.S. House and Senate should be to ask all 14 outside board of directors to testify and ask them who knew what and when. If you want to make real changes and look for real solutions to problems, it often has to go beyond the CEO. The boards have to be accountable as well. These board members are very knowledgeable and smart individuals who are being paid a lot of money at Wells to do their job. Question is, did they? And the other Viewpoint article is headlined, Know What It Takes to Be an Entrepreneur. And this is written by Laura Stack, who gives speeches and seminars on sales and leadership productivity. She's the author of 7 books, including Doing the Right Things Right, How the Effective Executive Spends Time. One of the axioms of the entrepreneurial community is that the working world consists of 2 basic types of people, born entrepreneurs and born employees. I don't think it's necessarily that simple, but it's true that the vast majority of people go to work for a fairly set number of hours each week and they receive benefits and a paycheck. Entrepreneurs can definitely be made, given a determination to internalize the things a natural entrepreneur is born knowing. Thank goodness for the natural employees, because the rest of us business owners, no matter how big or small, need staff. So what distinguishes the born entrepreneur from the rest of the crowd? Entrepreneurial habits. I've been an entrepreneur since I was 10 years old and offered dog sitting, house sitting, and babysitting services. If I look at myself, I think it's a sense of independence, the ability to self-motivate, reluctance to waste time on low-value activities, not liking to be told what to do, a tendency to take repeated, calculated risks, impatience with bureaucracy, and a hard-driving determination to get ahead. In fact, Entrepreneur Magazine lists 50 habits of the born entrepreneur. Many of these characteristics also get people labeled as troublemakers, and it's curious how similar they are to the attitude that often gets millennial workers labeled as aggressive, disloyal, and self-centered. Overcoming the label. The above notwithstanding, just because you're a business owner doesn't necessarily mean you're a born entrepreneur. It's the way you look at work. Is work more than work to you? Do you enjoy what you do so much you don't mind working strange, long, or different hours? Or is your job a way to earn a living, where you hang up your work attire promptly at 5 and turn off work? If the latter, you're a born employee. Learn to love the actions required to succeed and put them into play constantly. Take massive action toward the success you want and never be satisfied to rest on your laurels. Be open to new experiences and keep trying. Almost no one succeeds on the first try. Even most of the people on the Fortune 400 list of the richest people in the world have failed multiple times. If you can't do all that with a smile, knowing that you may still fail, then you may be better off working for someone else. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Amy Robertson, VP and Chief People Officer at Channel Advisor. E-commerce services provider Channel Advisor has named Amy Robertson, who had been at Red Hat, its Chief People Officer. What does a CPO do exactly? Robertson's responsibilities, in a nutshell, are to drive business results by focusing on talent-related strategies. Fundamentally, we are partners, consultants, and enablers of the business, she says. In the traditional sense, all that includes leading Channel Advisor's global human resources team to attract, develop, and retain top talent for the company. In the broader sense, Robertson and her team will lead the company's culture and engagement-related strategies and cultivate its employment brand. Morrisville-based Channel Advisor currently employs a total of 706 people. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I'm a businesswoman with a focus on people. That means we are analytical and data-driven, but creative, structured, yet flexible in order to pivot with our industry and business needs. What are some of your major goals in your new position? My focus right now is on culture, mission, values, and ensuring that every employee knows how they contribute to Channel Advisor's success. We are also refreshing our employer value proposition and building on our benefits. For example, we now offer 12 weeks of 100% paid maternity leave and an amazing collaborative and open workplace. Biggest pet peeve? Negativity. I try to surround myself with positive and energetic people. Biggest worry? My kids' future happiness and success. Education, bachelor's degree in applied mathematics from NC State University. Last book you've read? City of Heavenly Fire by Cassandra Clare. And now we turn to news from around the state. The first headline, Duke Energy closes deal for Piedmont Natural Gas. This article is written by John Downey. Duke Energy now has more than 1.5 million natural gas customers as its $4.9 billion purchase of Piedmont Natural Gas closed the morning of October 3. Tom Skanes has retired from Piedmont and his job as CEO has disappeared. He became a member of the Duke Board of Directors. Piedmont is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Duke. It will keep its name and its Charlotte headquarters. Frank Yoho, formerly Piedmont's chief commercial officer, is now head of Duke's natural gas operations. That includes Duke's 525,000 natural gas customers in Ohio and Kentucky, and Piedmont's 1 million customers in the Carolinas and Tennessee. It also includes commercial natural gas operations, such as Piedmont's storage and pipeline investments, and Duke's investments, the Sabah Trail Pipeline and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Duke and Dominion Resources also have closed on a deal for Dominion to acquire 3% of the Atlantic Pipeline from Duke. After the sale and the merger closing, Dominion owns 48% of the pipeline, Duke 47%, and Southern Company 5%. Duke says that the merger will initially be invisible to customers. Customers will continue to pay their local Piedmont and Duke utilities for gas and electricity as they always have. There will be no immediate changes in customer service phone numbers, billing options, or service request procedures. Tanger renovating its Triad headquarters. This article by Steve Huffman. Extensive renovations are underway on about 41,000 square feet of office space at Tanger Factory Outlet Center's corporate headquarters at 3200 Northline Avenue in Greensboro. A building permit for the $899,432 project was issued to Winston-Salem's Landmark Builders of the Triad. Tanger occupies only a portion of the Signature Place building, a former enclosed mall that was converted in the late 1990s into office space near the Friendly Center retail shopping complex. Ren Wells, a representative of Landmark, described the work as an upfit of an existing office space. He said officials with Tanger wanted to consolidate space to get more of their employees on the building's main floor. The project will be completed in phases, Wells said, with some of the work finished within a couple of weeks and all to be done by the end of the year. Tanger Factory Outlet Centers Incorporated is a publicly traded REIT, REIT, headquartered in Greensboro that operates and owns or has an ownership interest in 43 upscale outlet shopping centers and one under construction. The properties are located in 21 states and in Canada. BB&T agrees to $83 million fine with feds. BB&T Corporation has agreed to pay $83 million to settle allegations that it originated and underwrote mortgage loans backed by the Federal Housing Administration that did not meet applicable requirements. The U.S. Department of Justice announced the settlement with the Winston-Salem-based bank on September 29. The allegations are that BB&T failed to comply with certain FHA origination, underwriting, and quality control requirements. The FHA program depends on eligible lenders endorsing only eligible loans for FHA mortgage insurance and complying with HUD's quality control requirements, said Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Benjamin C. Miser, head of the Justice Department's Civil Division. Lenders like BB&T that participate in the FHA program must make adherence to the FHA program rules a priority. While profiting from the FHA program, BB&T exposed the taxpayers to losses by failing to comply with HUD guidelines and then took the additional step of falsely certifying that it had complied with such guidelines, said U.S. Attorney John Horn of the Northern District of Georgia. BB&T has been participating in the program since 2006. Cary's Waverly Place begins to rebound. This article is written by Amanda Hoyle. In the year and a half since the Waverly Place Shopping Center in Cary went under new ownership and management, much has been happening behind the scenes. The new owners have put close to $1 million in facility and facade improvements, and they are looking to attract new tenants and shoppers to the center, says Sandy Spurgin, Senior Vice President of Operations and Development for Northwood Retail. Dallas-based Northwood Retail acquired the sprawling center at the corner of Tryon and Kildare Farm Roads in December 2014. Since taking over, Spurgin says they've signed five new tenants, including the Gonza Tacos and Tequila restaurant that's expected to open in the spring. There's also the new Core Power Yoga, Parlor Blow Dry Bar, the Joint Chiropractic Clinic, and a refresh at Delphi Fitness and Wellness that were all targeted to bring more daily shopper and visitor traffic. When Gonza opens, we'll be at 80% occupancy, Spurgin says. We've been executing on our business plan and we're happy about the long-term potential for the project. The Cinebistro movie theater and restaurant complex, which anchors the north side of the complex, opened in August 2015 after signing a deal at Waverly Place in 2013. Of the 28 current retail tenants at Waverly Place, more than half are North Carolina-owned and operated independent businesses. Spurgin says there is also a plan to build a 4,000-square-foot building next to the promenade lawn area so they can add two more restaurants with outdoor dining overlooking the park. The intent is to better bridge the upper and lower levels of the center, he says. We think this little building will help create a more cohesive district. Waverly Place, which opened in 1988 with a multi-level horseshoe of shops, was an edgy new retail destination at the time. However, it had mostly fallen out of relevance by the mid-2000s. Durham Warehouse sells to New York firm for a record price. A Durham distribution warehouse and operation center built for the Peter Millar sportswear brand that opened in August has already sold to a new investor group for $11.4 million. The deal sets a price record for an industrial property in the Carolinas. Durham real estate records show Gramercy Property Trust of New York acquired the 115,000-square-foot building at 1002 Twin Creeks Court for $99 per square foot, the highest per square foot price in the Carolinas, according to the HFF Commercial Real Estate Capital Markets Group. Industrial pricing per square foot in the Raleigh-Durham market is the highest in the Southeast outside of the Miami-South Florida market, says Chris Norvell, Senior Managing Director at HFF. It is the only Carolinas market where new construction is starting to trade. Other markets, such as Charlotte and Charleston, will follow once developers begin to sell assets with new construction rental rates in place. Norvell says the Triangle industrial market, which is much smaller than those in Charlotte and the Triad, also has some of the highest rent, with rates for newer Class A industrial buildings pushing $5 per square foot or higher. The Triangle also has a dearth of suitable sites for new industrial development and higher construction costs compared to other Southeast markets. The Durham industrial property has a long-term lease contract in place with Peter Millar for the next 12 years. And that article was also written by Amanda Hoyle. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of Jim Verdonick's column. Jim Verdonick is an attorney with Warden Smith PA in Raleigh. The headline, Entrepreneurs Need to Become More Realistic. Last month, I attended a technology entrepreneur conference. The usual crowd was there, 200 entrepreneurs, three investors, not counting investors who said they were looking for later stage businesses, and 800 service providers. That's the reality of trying to find early money. Speaking of reality, it's easy to lose sight of reality while spending 2 days in a windowless conference center with 1,000 people hyped on the entrepreneurism drug. We often call entrepreneurs visionaries, but Webster's definition of visionary includes illusory, incapable of being realized or achieved, utopian and existing only in imagination, unreal. One conference speaker asked, what are the challenges in entrepreneurship? To me, the biggest challenge is to convince entrepreneurs to quit before they waste too much time and money. We have many diagnostic tools that predict business successes and failures, but these tools produce many false positives and false negatives. So the overly optimistic or desperate continue to use 125-foot-long bungee cords to jump into 100-foot-deep canyons with predictable results. Splat. While immediate death is rare, other negative results are common. Divorce, foreclosures, lost savings, and lost career opportunities. No one at conferences mentions this. It's not considered polite. I think the biggest unanswered challenge in entrepreneurship is to remind entrepreneurs to measure their bungee cords against their challenges. What entrepreneurs need is the equivalent of a stop-loss order that limits their losses to predefined amounts that entrepreneurs decide they can afford to lose before the entrepreneurism drug clouds their judgment. Unfortunately, that requires altering human nature, which includes the overly optimistic and desperate. When we say that freedom isn't really free, we should recognize that our economic freedom is paid for by wounded entrepreneurs. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.